So, good afternoon, everyone. So nice to see your smiling faces. And thank you, Susan.
Michael, you're still muted.
Thank you, Jacob. I just want to say good afternoon again. Good to see your smiling faces. And thank you for hanging in. Dogen is a bit of a tough nut, I think, to approach, and I appreciate your patience and maybe even courage as we kind of dive into this. I think, as has been mentioned earlier, you know, evil is a pretty strong word, and it's not a word I use. Very much. And yet sometimes I noticed almost involuntary the word comes forward when I'm confronted with some particularly tragic or inhumane actions that, you know, we human beings seem to inflict on each other and the world. Thinking now of things like, you know, the mass shootings, suicide bombings, drone attacks, racial violence, sexual violence, genocide, rampant greed, self-centeredness, destroying our climate, and, you know, the list goes on and on. We can never come to the end. And that's just in our lifetime. You know, the human history seems to be soaked in evil actions or unwholesome actions. And as a result, or maybe just in line with this, one fundamental thing that religious traditions have in common is this quest of how to confront unwholesomeness, how to confront evil in every place and time. People have come to terms with what they experienced as evil, or as unwholesome actions. Diverse schools of philosophy throughout history have reflected on possible sources and causes of evil. And the attempt to come to grips with the phenomenon of evil has always been a central concern to the major religious traditions. In the few paragraphs that we looked at this morning, in this writing by Dogen, Dogen tells us that evil or unwholesome actions are not outside us, not separate, but part of who we are, part of our reality. And so again, if this is the case, how do we approach our life? This task is not an easy one, and one that many believers, practitioners of the traditions of the world have grappled with over the centuries. How do we meet and practice our own unwholesome actions? And I was thinking about this, I remembered from my young years when I was in confirmation class at the Anglican Church. I remembered we studied the Apostle Paul's confession in the biblical New Testament book of Romans. And maybe you who have or who are Christians and have studied the Bible at all, this will be quite familiar. And it's a quote that I think resonates in the hearts of many. So here it is, the Apostle Paul. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate to do, I do. I have desire to do what is good, but cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. When I want to do good, evil is right there with me. This struggle, on some level, seems so clear and easy. You know, avoid all evil, do all good. But when we come close and really looking at our actions, the actions of the world around us by other people, it's really quite a challenge. And I think Dogen is bringing us back to really look closely at this challenge. So let's continue on. I'm going to skip the paragraph 6 and go on to the next paragraph, paragraph 7 here. And I'm going to read 7 and 8 and then again talk about it a little bit. When you refrain from unwholesome action, the power of practice is immediately actualized. This is actualized on the scale of the entire earth, the entire universe, all time, all dharmas. This is the scale of refrain from. This very person at this moment abides in the place, comes from it and goes to it, where no unwholesome action is created. No unwholesome action is created, although the person appears to be faced with the conditions of creating unwholesome action or of associating with those who create unwholesome action. So now Dogen pushes us. Refrain from unwholesome actions in this way that Dogen is describing it goes beyond a kind of injunction or imperative, you know, avoid unwholesome actions. Rather, I think at this point, as Dogen explains it, it becomes a dharma gate manifesting the whole universe. Because the I of I will refrain from unwholesome action drops away. As does the I who does good action. No I. If we really want to practice good and avoid evil, we need to see that the nature of good and evil exactly as it is. We get caught in our notions of right and wrong, wants and preferences. Dogen is telling us that there is a deeper life that opens beyond the I striving to refrain from unwholesome actions and to do wholesome actions. When that sense of I, me, softens or recedes, there is a place where no unwholesome action can be created. Dogen will expand on this a little bit later, but what he implies is that actions free from self-centeredness accord naturally with the good, and that virtue manifests itself when human artifice is dropped. This very person at this moment abides in the place, comes from it and goes to it, where no unwholesome action is created. I think of this, you know, at times, like, you know, a mother or father reaching down to pick up their crying child without thinking anything. Just a natural act of compassion. Not seeing a difference between themselves and their crying child at that moment. I don't think the parent thinks, oh, I'm doing good, or this will help the kid. Maybe sometimes, of course. But there's so many times it's just the reaching out. Just the reaching out. And at that moment, virtue is manifest of itself. Compassion arises naturally in itself. So paragraph 9. When the power of refrain from is actualized, unwholesome action does not manifest as unwholesome action. So in other words, the potential is not manifest. The potential of unwholesome action does not come into being or is not actualized. Unwholesome action has no fixed form. You can pick it up or let it go. At the moment we understand this, we know that unwholesome action does not overcome a person, and a person does not destroy unwholesome action. So the power, this power that Dogen is talking about, this power of refrain from, is actualized when we step away from our self-centeredness. When we function from a place of our whole life, the life that is inclusive of everything, at that point there's no manifestation of unwholesomeness. There's nothing fixed there. No fixed evil or unwholesomeness. So for example, a knife, a very useful tool in the kitchen, or a weapon in the hands of a thug. Much depends on how we pick it up, how we intend to use it. If we are centered in our life, if we are centered in the wholeness of our life, this inclusive life that we are part of, then we're not swept away by unwholesome actions or swept away by our greed, hate, and delusion that lead unwholesome actions to come into being. And we don't view some actions as inherently unwholesome or wholesome. In other words, there's no need to judge because we are intimate with everything. Our Zazen practice gives us each, I think, a vast and inclusive view. You know, sitting on the cushion, the mind quieting down. And our Zazen perhaps gives us a better position to respond to the suffering then that we encounter. The Greek physician Hippocrates, in his work of the epidemics, apparently wrote something like, first, do no harm. I think we've all heard that. But I believe this is only possible if we first soften our self-centeredness, enabling a more inclusive view of the moment. Hard views of right and wrong can get in the way. We may say, perhaps, that unwholesome action is the obstruction of our true nature. Sometimes, when I'm trying to explain a little bit of this idea of Buddha nature or this idea of all-inclusive life to my students when I was teaching at SFU, I would describe it using the image of like the students going down on spring break to Puerto Vallarta, walking on a beach, right hand holding a pina colada, they're walking along, and they step on a thorn. The foot feels the pain. But the hand doesn't think, well, I'm busy, I'm holding the pina colada, deal with it yourself. There's no thought of good or bad, right or wrong. Immediately the hand puts down the pina colada, reaches down and plucks out the thorn. That is the wholeness of our life. That is what Dogen is urging us to wake up to. The crying child is not the other. The crying child is you. So paragraph 10. When you rouse your entire mind and let it practice, and when you arouse your entire body and let it practice, 8 or 9 out of 10 are accomplished before questioning, and refrain from unwholesome action was actualized after knowing. When you bring forth your body, mind, and practice, and when you bring forth that body, mind, and practice of others, the power of practice with the 4 elements and the 5 skandhas is immediately actualized. Without defiling the self of the 4 elements and the 5 skandhas, the 4 elements and the 5 skandhas of today are practiced. The power of the 4 elements and 5 skandhas practiced at this moment actualizes the practice of the 4 elements and the 5 skandhas in the past. Well, there's a lot of kind of Buddhist terminology and going back and forth here. But Dogen, these are the key points, I think, in this part. Arousing the mind and body in practice is setting our intention, and setting our intention is 80 to 90% of refraining from unwholesome action. Notice it's body and mind. And Dogen is really insistent on this in all his writing. It's not our mind, it's our whole being, body and mind together. So of course we want to avoid unwholesome action. And Dogen says, yeah, good, good, that's 80, 90%. But it's not 100. And clearly, in this first part, Dogen is asking us to use our whole practice, our zazen, our precepts study and understanding, our study of other Buddhist texts, our work practice, our chanting, our vows, all of that becomes part of refrain from unwholesome action. And then the 4 elements, which are the physical elements that make up the world, right? Earth, water, fire, air. And the 5 skandhas, those are the kind of components of a human being, the body, sensation, perception, mental formations, consciousness. These are traditional Buddhist ways of analyzing or understanding experience in the world. So in this point, Dogen shifts our view of practice away from I and me doing the practice to the kind of microcosm of our physical and mental components. Our perception, our body, our mind. And not only in the present moment, but of the past too, all that conditioning of everything we've experienced and everything we're experiencing at this moment coming together, this kind of microcosm of all these components. That the good conditions, the energy that we experience now, including the results of preceding thoughts and actions, are all brought into this refrain from unwholesome action. In this way, the power of practice is actualized, it's brought to life, and we open up to our all-inclusive reality of the world. We open up to our total experience. Because when the notion of, or the voice, notion and voice, I say, of the inner me drops away, what is there? It's just your life. And everything around you is there. What separation could there possibly be? So after this kind of pointing out this microcosm of who we are is all involved in this refraining from, he then turns the gaze outward. And in the paragraph 11, when you move mountains, rivers, and earth, as well as the sun, the moon, and stars to practice, they in turn move you to practice. This is not the open eye of just one time, but the vital eye of all times, because it is all the open eye, the vital eye of all times. You move all Buddhas and all ancestors to practice, to listen to the teaching and to realize the fruit. Okay. Nothing is left out of the vast, intricate web of Buddha Dharma, of this cosmos. All is intimate and interconnected. And maybe you've heard of the image of Indra's net, an image of the cosmos as a vast, multidimensional net, with jewels lying at each of the intersecting nodes, and each jewel reflecting the light of every other jewel. Each node was intimately and immediately interconnected with each and every other node, each and every node participating in and reflecting the totality of the cosmos. This is what Dogen is talking about here. You may think that you practice by yourself, but that is not really the case. You are moved by mountains and rivers, earth, sun, moon, and you move them in your practice. And it's not just this moment that you're practicing, but all time is present, this vital eye of all time. The ancestors are, and the Buddhas, their practice, their influence is present here, just as yours is present with them. The benefits of the earth and sky, air, water, heat, food, all beings are woven into our practice. All beings support our practice, and our practice reflects them. Our practice, in turn, supports them. Although we may only be aware of this for a moment or two at a time, it is the case all the time. During this time of COVID, most of us have spent so much time indoors. And I have too. And yet, every day when I step outside, and Kate and I are very fortunate to live in an area with large trees, every time I step outside, I wake up. Some small way, sometimes it's a more significant way. These trees have been here all the time. And they speak. They speak. And what they say is, you're here. Practicing Zazen, all the Buddhas and ancestors speak. We are all Buddhas and ancestors. Their practice and ours are not two. And this may sound kind of like poetic license, right? But Dogen, in his writings here and other places, makes it clear that this intimacy with all Buddhas and ancestors goes beyond our understanding. It goes beyond the poetic. And you might say it's kind of mystical, but that would just be to put another label on it, I think. So let's unpack this a little bit more by looking at the next paragraph here. 12. Since all Buddhas and ancestors have not allowed the teaching, practice, and enlightenment to be divided, the teaching, practice, and enlightenment have not hindered all Buddhas and ancestors. For this reason, when you move Buddhas and ancestors to practice, none of them are separated from before or after your realization, either in the past, present, or future. At the time when sentient beings become Buddhas and ancestors, they become Buddhas and ancestors without hindering the Buddhas and ancestors who already exist. Ponder this point closely while walking, abiding, sitting, lying down throughout the 12 hours of the day. It is not that a sentient being is destroyed, taken away, or lost by becoming a Buddha ancestor, but that a sentient being drops away. Well, this is kind of typical Dogen language and expression. But again, let me just kind of pick out what I can. See if this helps. In all of Dogen's teachings here as well, he tells us that the usual view that we hear teachings, we practice, and we awaken, like a 1-2-3 step, is not really the right way of looking at this. That these three things are not separate. There's no steps in figuring out how to proceed from one to the other or what the differences are. And he says this has always been the case. All the Buddhas and ancestors have not allowed any mistaken views of the vision to arise. Our practice and the practice of our ancestors are not different, not separate, in any sense of place or time. And Dogen drives home the truth of our radical inclusivity and profound interconnectedness throughout this text and throughout many of his other texts. And this is hard to really appreciate, except maybe when we're on the cushion or when we step into the forest. But there's other ways this is true as well, you know, kind of things we're just beginning to learn in science. And I was reading a short article on mitochondrial DNA, right? And researchers have traced mitochondrial DNA back, all like our common mitochondrial DNA, back to one woman in the past, 150,000 to 200,000 years ago, we shared a common ancestor. Everyone on the planet is related to this woman. And there's something similar that I haven't really explored yet on the Y chromosome, the male chromosome. But that only goes back to 60,000 years. So I'm not quite sure about all that. But I think the woman, they dubbed her the mitochondrial Eve. Our ancestors. It's not something woo-woo, so to speak. I think it's something vital and alive. And when we open to it, our life becomes more vital and alive. Dogen in the same passage goes on to say, you know, in our Zazen practice particularly, we drop, right? We let our thinking just settle, the mind calms. The usual oppositional mode of thinking of right and wrong, good and evil, Buddhas and sentient beings, that drops away. Our awakened activity, our expression of our Buddha nature, does not eliminate or is not eliminated by our sense of being an individual. Yet, the thought of or consciousness of me or I am doing good does not arise, since that in that activity there's no separation between the self and other. Like the parent picking up the crying child. Even though the parent knows at the same time I'm the parent and the child is the child. In another way, there is no parent and child. So in that sense, I think this is what Dogen means by sentient being drops away. It doesn't mean that you disappear, but now perhaps that your quirks and your shortcomings, they become awakened quirks and shortcomings. In other words, they're no longer hindrances. And you're not hurting yourself, and you're not hurting others. You simply manifest awakened, wholesome action. Okay, we'll do one, Either I wrote too much or I don't speak fast enough. I'm not sure which it is. How can I get through all this? Okay. Let's look at the paragraphs 13, 14, 15 here. When you allow the cause and effect of wholesome and unwholesome actions to practice, it is not that you put cause and effect into action, or that you create cause and effect, but cause and effect at times allow you to practice. The original face of cause and effect is already clear. Because this is dropping away, it is refrained from, unborn, impermanent, not ignoring, and not dropping. When you study in this way, you realize that unwholesome action is none other than refrained from. Assisted by this realization, you see through, and by sitting, you cut through refraining from unwholesome action. The consequences of our actions, whether good actions or bad actions, are what we train with. Taking cause and effect as a problem, we often try to fix the cause and effect. When we practice refrain from, we allow cause and effect to practice. What does that mean? Well, I think when we meet each moment of our life, we try not to push away the unwanted, because in this way we push ourselves away from life. This is allowing cause and effect to practice. Let me repeat that. We try not to push away the unwanted, because in that way we push ourselves away from life itself. We don't ignore, of course, what must be done. We try not to create harmful actions or to stir things up, but the conditions we have created and have been created for us, whatever they are, they will lead us to practice. Think what brought you to practice. Sometimes it is our suffering and confusion. Sometimes we are inspired by a person or a passage that we've read. Whatever the cause and effect, something has brought us to practice. Can we say what brought us to practice, if it was our suffering and discomfort, was unwholesome? Interesting. Once the face of our conditioning is clear, in other words, when we see clearly our own suffering rather than flinching away from it, and when we see past self-satisfaction, self-involvement, hurts and confusion, that kind of all the unwholesomeness, perhaps we could say, within, we deeply come to know refrain from means the unborn, the endless flow of change, and of letting go. We meet it, not pushing it away. We see it for what it is. that whatever it is, it's just our life at this moment. We may even say it's our Buddha nature at this moment. And when we study in this way, we see that unwholesome action is not separate. And with this realization, we penetrate to the core of unwholesome action, and we see there is no separate evil or unwholesomeness. Rather, there is boundless openness. The open place beneath the separation of selves and that this place is inseparable from all interdependent phenomena. With this deep seeing, we are free, at least until we entangle ourselves once again with the next kind of self-centered thought. So you can see here, you know, Dogen is using this refrain from in a rather unique way. It's not the conscious mind saying, don't do that, don't do that. It's something a little deeper. It doesn't exclude that, but we need to really question, what is this refrain from? And use it, as Dogen suggests, as a kind of Dharma gate. Okay, I'm just going to, let me just, I may have to skip some of these here. Okay. So we'll do one more, and then I'm going to ask you to do a little exercise here. This is number 16. At the beginning, middle, and end, as refrain from unwholesome action is actualized, then unwholesome action does not arise through causes and conditions. It is just refrain from. Unwholesome action does not cease through causes and conditions. It is just refrain from. As unwholesome action is all-inclusive, all dharmas are all-inclusive. So from the very beginning, from the first time we are told or we read, refrain from unwholesome action, and we struggle to put that into practice, there is benefit. Penetrating the core, or penetrating to the core of refraining from unwholesome action with our practice, at that moment we stop giving life to the causes and conditions that allow unwholesome actions to manifest. So rather than responding to unwholesome actions as if they were outside us, we come to know that what is unwholesome is not separate. And we practice just refrain from. And when you commit to the investigation of refrain from, you are held by refrain from. That was interesting. I think what he's saying, you know, in our practice, words and phrases can kind of whirl around in our minds. You know, doing this, don't do that. Even in our Zazen practice, right? But Dogen asks us to cut through all of that stuff to the very core of refrain from unwholesome action. And don't become entangled with speculation about the causes and conditions. Look closely, to look very closely at your life, to see the nakedness of your life before we clothe it with our thoughts, desires, and things. That is refrain from. Refrain from, we could say, is our Zazen. In Zazen, of course, thoughts arise. Good thoughts, bad thoughts, we can label them all kinds of ways, but we don't allow them to take hold in our practice. We don't become entangled with them. We don't invest in them. We don't make them into me. We open the hand of thought, as one Zen teacher puts it. That is what we do. Okay. So here's what I'd like you to do. We've read 16 paragraphs at the moment. I'd like you to look at the... Everyone has the text? One formula? Anyone not? Like just... Okay, it seems like everyone says yes. So, and I'd like you to just mark a phrase, a word that you find either intriguing, insightful, or appealing in some way. Is that kind of clear? So we'll just take a couple of minutes. Go look at the passages that we've talked about. And underline or mark in some way so that you can share them with others. And, you know, passages that you find intriguing or insightful or in whatever way kind of appeal to you, even if you don't understand them. Maybe especially if you don't quite understand it. Let's mark that. So we'll just do that for a moment, and then I'll come back with a question as well for us to consider. Okay, I see a few people are still making some marks, and that's fine. And I'm going to put you into groups in just a moment, and I'd like you to share one or two or three of those comments and your thoughts about that particular passage that you marked. And the question I'd like you to consider is, remember that passage of the New Testament that I read to you, of Paul lamenting, when I want to do good, evil is right there with me. How would you respond to Paul? How would you respond to this lament of Paul? And it could be, you know, not so much maybe an answer, although you may have one. You may want to give him some Dogen to read. But how would you respond? I mean, would you say, yes, I see that too in my own life? Is there an example to share? In whatever way you feel appropriate. How would you respond to Paul? Because in a way, we respond to our own life, right? Okay, so I'll put people into groups, and